Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 72, Always Lead with Porn.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that's simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to twill.hover.com.
Hello, and welcome to This Week in Law with Denise Howell. We're recording on August 6, 2010. I am your hostess here today, but I'm not going to be able to get you a table. What I'm going to be able to get you are heaping helpings of internet and technology law from our fabulous panel, including Kevin Thompson of Davis McGrath in Chicago. Welcome to back to the show, Kevin.
Thank you for having me, Denise.
Great to have you back. Kevin, of course, blogs at cyberlawcentral.com in addition to practicing technology law. And joining us once again, too, is Jonathan Bailey down in New Orleans from plagiarismtoday.com. Hi. Hi, Jonathan.
Glad to be here. Probably my favorite way to spend a Friday afternoon here in New Orleans.
Oh, wow. That's saying a lot. So thank you so much. It's great to have you. Joining us, too, from San Francisco, Alex McGilvery from brickallure.org is his blog, and he's with a little startup that's still mostly in stealth mode. You may have heard of it. It's called Twitter, and Alex is Twitter's general counsel. So great to have you on the show, Alex.
Great to be here. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good, good. Well, we're thrilled to have all of you together today. We have lots to talk about. The thing I'd like to start off with, actually, Alex, you posted on it on BrickAllure, your blog, is the DMCA exemptions. And we've talked a lot about them both on the show and on other TWiT shows. But I'm still personally trying to unpack how all of these are going to work. And one issue that keeps coming up in my mind, and you raised it in your post, Alex, is it's all well and good for these exemptions to have been issued on things like jailbreaking and using limited clips of other videos in non-commercial and educational videos and breaking CSS in order to do it. But it leaves you with the issue of, well, okay, if you're allowed to do this, is someone else also allowed to make the applications that will enable general lay people to accomplish these tasks? Because I know when I pick up my iPhone without some additional assistance, I'm not going to be able to jailbreak it. So I'm wondering, Alex, what are your thoughts on that? And do you think that these exemptions really have any impact if people can't also take the extra step and make the applications necessary for folks to accomplish the task?
I think they do have impact. There are a bunch of people who can do this themselves, and that's certainly well within the exception. I think the other thing is, you know, before we get to sort of the bad news that the exceptions don't cover some parts of the DMCA, there's a lot of good news in them. Just the fact that we finally got some exemptions, given the fact that these were really due in October of, I think, last year. And so actually getting them out there was a big deal. And then some of the wording within them really takes the advantages that we got the last time these exemptions were done in 2006 and solidifies them. This was the idea that it's not necessarily just a class of works, but that those classes can also include usage. And then also some signals from the Copyright Office about the things that they would consider to be fair use in a digital age, which are very big statements, even without any applicability to people actually using them. And then, like I say, I do think that there are a bunch of people who can use these without additional tools. And those folks obviously are well within the law now. The question of whether the tools will further be regulated or whether there'll be any cases against these tools is a whole nother one. And that is certainly not a completely done area of law, but it is something that we'll see more work on in the next few years, I would expect.
Kevin, do you agree with me that it's left sort of up in the air as to whether you're an application maker, if you make something that breaks CSS for these purposes, or jailbreaks an iPhone, and then you proceed to charge for that product in addition, whether that's something that's going to be protected under these exemptions? I'm thinking no, but what do you think?
I tend to agree with you, Denise. If you read the registrar's statement when he made these rules, he pretty much acknowledges that all he can do is grant an exemption for 1201A, but he can't, for example, like Alex was pointing out, grant an exemption for 1202 or some of the other aspects of the DMCA. But what was within his power was 1201A, and he was able to give that exemption. I certainly think that a court looking at a case brought by someone after this rulemaking has gone on will, you know, take a look at the fair use analysis that the registrar gives in support of his analysis. It might be beneficial for somebody making such an argument, but I would certainly imagine that somebody could be prosecuted still for actually creating one of these tools.
Yeah, it's the fair use discussion that gives me concern about it, and the fact that it's not expressly addressed. Which is kind of surprising to go through the registrar's analysis and commentary in connection with this rulemaking is over 250 pages long. And I can't pretend to have read the entire thing, but I haven't, in the parts I've read so far, find anything that actually addresses this specific situation, which is sort of surprising because I don't know how you get to the, you know, it's true, as Alex says, that there are people that can take full advantage of this themselves, but I don't think that's the vast majority of electronic owning and using consumers out there.
Well, it goes back to the structure of the statute in terms of the 1201A1, which is about the actual circumvention of these controls, and then there's 1201A2, which is about the sort of the manufacture and trafficking of circumvention devices for access. And then 1201B, which is about the copy controls, and it's about just the manufacture and trafficking of the tools. So I don't think that Mary Beth Peters was even interested in. I mean, there's no reason to talk about the other ones because the actual rulemaking process is only about this 1201A1 exemption. It was the only part of the statute that Congress saw fit to protect with this exemption rulemaking process. So it's almost like, you know, of course they didn't talk too much about, you know, how cars work because they're boat builders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Hey, Jonathan, any thoughts on this aspect of the DMCA exemptions or any other?
You know, it's just an interesting case to me that, you know, you might be legally able to break, you know, the CSS, for example, or jailbreak an iPhone, whatever. But if you traffic in the tools, it could still be a problem. And I think it points to, honestly, a flaw in the law itself and how this particular portion was written. I mean, I've never been a particularly big fan of the anti-circumvention portion of the DMCA, but this really drives home the point that there might need to be, you know, some revisiting to this particular area of the law to address some of these problems, because this is a major headache. And if I were someone developing a jailbreaking app, I'd be very nervous right now. I've got to be honest. This wouldn't take a load off my mind at all.
So another aspect of this that a listener / viewer of the show, Steve Feinstein, emailed me earlier this week, and I see that someone has brought it up in our IRC too. If you're listening live, you can join the IRC at irc.twit.tv. We'd love to see you there. And that is the question of the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act and its impact on someone like Apple. And what it is a consumer protection law that requires certain steps to be taken by folks selling products to consumers. And if you're going to issue a warranty, there are certain minimum requirements that have to be given there. And if you dig into the law under, I think it's 15 U.S.C. section 2304C, if anyone wants to look it up, it says that in order to take a manufacturer out of its warranty obligations, enable them to void the warranty. The customer has to actually damage the phone. The word used in the statute is, or the item. The word used in the statute is damage. But if a consumer does something that's expressly blessed under the DMCA, as jailbreaking now is, do you guys think that that necessarily would constitute damage? Kevin, what do you think?
It might be damaged. The other point I point out, if you actually read Section C, it's either damage or unreasonable use, which could include failure to provide reasonable and necessary maintenance is the example given there for unreasonable use actually in the statute. Damage has to not result from defect or malfunction. So damage could be an overt act done by the user to the phone, to break into the software might be considered damage under Apple's reading of the statute, or it could be considered unreasonable use as well, if they consider that to be, because there's no real definition given as to what unreasonableness is.
Right. Alex, if Apple decides to play hardball on this and voids the warranty for people who jailbreak, would you be surprised to see a consumer class action pushing some of these points?
Well, consumer class actions would never surprise me. But I think the one of the bigger questions there is how you've got a company that's traditionally been an equipment manufacturer. And a sort of end user, non-connected software manufacturer that's moving more and more into devices that are really a package. So the question, one question is, can you bring your iPhone in the phone itself, if you damage the software but not the phone? And another question would be, well, what about if you damage the phone but not the software? It's unclear that we either have law or that some of these companies are experienced with all of the different places where their businesses now exist.
Right. Steve's question to me was, if he voids his warranty, whether if his earbuds break, that he's out of luck. And I think that would be pretty tenuous, but, who knows?
Yeah.
Jonathan, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say that the earphone example would be very tenuous. I would actually look at the earphones, for example, as being a separate item than the iPhone. I think mere fact that you can disconnect it and use it with other devices. But, it's very interesting to me. This is a classic example of a relatively recent law already being out of date, because you can tell by reading it, they intended it largely like auto manufacturers, just the language of it, proper maintenance and so forth. They were really aiming it more at that angle rather than I believe it was Kevin just mentioned devices with a software and a hardware component built in. But then again, cars are pretty much nothing but giant computers now either. So I guess I might want to sit down and shut up.
All right. Well, somebody who's not sitting down and shutting up is tax assessor, I believe it is, in Riverhead, New York, who is industriously using Google Earth to go out and locate people with pools in their yards who do not have the adequate permits and licensing to have those pools. This comes to us from the Google Earth blog. And I just thought it was kind of an interesting twist on, everybody has various concerns or anecdotes about Google Earth and the way that unusual information can be gleaned out of it. Here is a law enforcement kind of arm going around and trying to raise revenues by scouring Google Earth. And I guess it's not the first time this has happened. The Google Earth blog also mentions that there was a tax assessor, they didn't mention the city, that were looking up new structures that might not be permitted and going out and issuing new tax bills. So I thought that was pretty interesting and just wanted to float it by you guys. Are you concerned that Google Earth is a tool that's now being adopted by law enforcement or civic revenue arms? What do you think, Kevin?
I personally am not that upset about it. I seem to recall back from my con law days that helicopters were perfectly acceptable. So I can't imagine a satellite in space is any worse. One of the fun things recently I've seen with Google Earth is near my house here in Chicago, Google Earth happened to catch a passing 747 going overhead, taking off from O'Hare. So if you look at it real carefully, it looks like the 747 is part of the street. But the other use I've seen recently for Google Earth and pools, kind of interesting, is in the UK, I happen to hear of these kids were using Google Earth to find pools that were available. Like, for example, if the homeowners were away on vacation, they were able to use that to figure out just, you know, where the pools were. And then these people would come back home to discover that they had a sort of an unannounced pool party while they were gone.
Wow. And I think you just gave every skateboarder in Southern California a resource to go find dry pools to go pursue their
passion. For this, I really don't see any problem with the police using or any other law enforcement official using a common tool like Google Earth, you know, to find things that are out in plain view. If they'd worked with them to come up with a special view, or you know, had them, you know, put a special camera up there, that'd be one thing. But they're just using the publicly accessible service, same as if they would have hired a helicopter to fly overhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think it's really interesting in the context, too, of Alex's company. And, you know, it's not just Google that is cataloging a great deal of data that previously was unavailable and unsearchable. Certainly, Twitter is in the same boat, and there are lots of other tools out there that are becoming these information sources that can be mined for various things. Alex, what do you think about all this?
I think it speaks really directly to this idea of publicly available information and unforeseen uses of that information. Mm-hmm. So when Google did that, I doubt they would have thought that a tax collector might use that information. But you have all sorts of unintended consequences. So the question from our perspective, where users are actually providing us with information, is how do we accurately convey the fact that this is public and that lots of people will be able to do all sorts of things that we don't even know they would do. So we work really hard on that. So one of those things is making sure that everybody knows that when they tweet to the world. Making sure that our privacy policy actually has a big section talking about the publicness of information. We actually, at one point, were thinking of calling our privacy policy a public policy.
Publicness or maybe policy?
Publicness or openness. We couldn't come up with a great name. But also, it's unclear under California law whether you'd be allowed to call your privacy policy something other than privacy policy.
Mm-hmm. Just give it a subtitle.
Yeah, exactly. But the bigger, I mean, we're lucky in this respect in that people come to Twitter to share things in the broadest possible way. You know, people don't think, Twitter is the right place to share, to have a conversation with my, you know, girlfriend about what we're going to do tomorrow in the public messages. Whereas there are other services where that's sort of their brand identification. And so they have a harder time of appropriately setting user expectations and appropriately having users understand all of the various uses of their data. So we just to recap, what we try to do is right at the beginning, give users a really expansive notion of all the things that may happen and on the fact that we don't even have control over what may happen with their information. We just had a new site that what they do is they read publicly available tweets. And they try to figure out what the how good a movie is, essentially, based on the publicly available tweets about the movie. Certainly not something we had ever thought of when we launched the service, but is part of what users might expect, given what we've told them about how widely their tweets will get distributed and used.
Have you incorporated anything about the Library of Congress's archiving Twitter information in what you're telling users? And is there any distinction that you're, you know, advising users as they sign up for the service or as they go and check out your privacy or publicness policy about how long Twitter is storing things and then where it might elsewhere be available?
Yeah, we've always, I mean, the Library of Congress deal was a great teaching moment for us, for our users. But even before that, of course, because otherwise we wouldn't have done the deal. But even before that, we were telling users that their tweets were accessible to the whole world. And we don't, you know, bury that in a privacy policy. We actually put that right with the tweet box. So the first time a user is tweeting, they know that very specifically. We do it in a whole bunch of other places on the site. And we tell people explicitly, too, that things like deleting a tweet after you tweet it, while we will delete it from our servers, there are many, many, many people who are downloading tweets, and we don't have agreements with many of them. And so you look at a site like the Internet Archive, which was archiving tweets well before the Library of Congress, right. And we want to make sure people understand that. So we're very, very specific when we talk to people about deletion, when we talk to people about that sort of stuff, that it really is already out there. And that even if we wanted to, we wouldn't be able to control the various uses that people make of tweets. So we try to make sure that, you know, it's not for everybody. And we want to make sure that people really understand that this is a very public form of communication and what that means.
As long as we're on the topic, the one form of communication you have that's not public, or not one wouldn't expect it to be very public, are direct messages. But I assume that from time to time you're hit with subpoenas on that front and have to take some sort of stand on what, how you're going to respond to those kinds of things as lawyers begin to discover. And I can tell you that they are discovering, because I just got asked to talk on this topic, Twitter as an e-discovery tool. So is that something that comes up a lot? And I know that, you know, you probably just have to respond to things as they come in, but is there any sort of policy that you have on making the more private information that's in your service public if it's demanded?
Yeah, we're a pretty crappy discovery tool, it turns out, for a number of reasons. First is that most of our stuff is public, so we're not going to be doing anything. And of course, we don't have to do anything there. But also on the private side, we take it really seriously. So you look at there was a leaked document. Actually, sorry, it wasn't leaked. It was acquired through FOIA by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where a number of law enforcement agencies had gotten together and were talking about all of the social networks and how much cooperation they were getting from the variety of social networks. And they included us, even though we're more of an information network than a social network. But I can't remember exactly what the quotation was from the slide, but it was something like, Twitter is really not great to deal with. It's very hard to get information from them. Whereas for some of the other networks out there, it was much easier. We also got into a big fight, not on contents of communication, which is what the actual contents of a DM are subject to a much higher standard than a mere subpoena. But but even on the addressing information, we had the district attorney of the state of Pennsylvania, who was running for governor, ask us to give the IP address and email address from sign-up information of a couple of users who were criticizing him. And we typically notify our users when it's not illegal to do so. So we had notified the users, and even before the users were able to mount their own defense, we had told the Attorney General that we were going to stand by our users on this. And we ended up getting the Attorney General, he dismissed the subpoena and withdrew it before any information was revealed. So I think our company posture is such that we're not a great place for people to come to with discovery, because we have no incentive to make it easy, given that we are trying to protect our users' interests. And then also, of course, there are higher standards for those types of things as well.
Yeah, that you tweeted right when you started your job at Twitter. That you might be able to blog more about copyright at Bricolore, which you recently did, because you weren't going to be dealing so much with those issues at work. And I imagine that that's true, but I'd be surprised if copyright doesn't come up for you at all. I'm sure you must get DMCA notices at Twitter, even though what you can reproduce in a series of 140 character chunks is somewhat limited.
Yeah, we really haven't gotten much at all. I mean, part of it is just 140 characters. It's a totally different thing than back in my old job at Google, where we had videos and you know, long blog posts and the like. But we do get them from time to time.
I've sent a few.
We do respond to them. But it's not,
you've
it's
sent
just
DMCA
not something
DMCA notices to Twitter?
Deal.
Yeah, I've had to send one or two. Both times it was about background images, though, not actual tweets. It was things, it was either, I can't remember if it was background images or icons, but it was images on Twitter, not actual tweets.
Mm-hmm. Like the wallpaper you see behind somebody's. Yeah, that's something I hadn't thought of. You must get, Alex, the impersonation anonymity questions in rapid fire manner. That seems to be.
You know, we do a little bit, although we have really strong protection there, so it allows us to get most of those out of the way really quickly. We have a pretty straightforward impersonation policy that also allows us to take action when someone is really impersonating somebody, but gives broad leeway for parody accounts like the BP Global PR account, which is
such a great account.
Yeah, a very darkly funny account.
I love it.
Here in New Orleans, it's a hit. Yeah, but we also find that people are getting smarter about what they do. So there are some accounts where you might think that we might have gotten an angry gram, where we just haven't received one because people are starting to understand the Barbara Streisand effect, understanding that when they make a big deal out of something that is not in fact illegal, that often what all they're doing is pointing attention to it.
Well, now that you can talk a little bit more about copyright, let's do that. We have some music stories in our list here. Thought it was pretty interesting on a couple of fronts here that Apple is now streaming music to iPhones, iPads, and iPod touches. It was also interesting that the person who brought this to my attention was Michael Robertson of MP3.com fame all those years ago. So it seems like perhaps Apple is still ironing out its licensing issues on all this because it seems to have happened very quietly. Kevin, did you take a look at this and do you have any thoughts on how far we've come from the MP3.com days to today?
Well, I certainly did read Michael's article that you put in the show notes. I personally haven't tried doing this myself, but it certainly looks like what they're doing is they're allowing people access to their own iDiscs remotely. It used to be you could only get certain types of soft things that you put up there. For example, I think you could only get pictures and documents. But according to this article, they're now labeled streaming of music as well. There's like a sort of a hidden feature where you have to check the box to allow play audio from your iDisc while using another app. And then once you do that, you're able to stream. I think that
so it doesn't exactly sound like Pandora at this point. Or
certainly
Lala
not Pandora.
No.
It's because this is your own music. You actually have to take a lot of steps to actually get it into iDisc. I don't think iTunes itself allows like an export. I think you have to figure out a third way to manually get the file there. But once you get it there, you can do it. I think it's completely different from like MP3.com, where you know the files were stored on the servers of the company.
But still, we've got tons of companies out there building on that MP3.com business model now. Michael Robertson must feel like he just, you know, wishes he could have been in some kind of time warp and teleported his whole business and business model forward a few years. So that he, instead of having the biggest, what was it, the biggest copyright damages judgment ever awarded against him and his company basically completely knocked out, You know, he could be in a situation of where this is now becoming the way that music is distributed, and the whole concept of having a locker in the cloud is something that seems to have gained some traction. Alex, do you think it's just a question of time and the record labels coming to terms with how people want to have music delivered to them?
Yeah, I don't know. So much of this reminds me of kids with their parents. It's like Michael is saying, "Oh, you know, daddy, that thing that you made me stop doing, they're, you know, my brother over there is doing it. Like, that's unfair." who knows whether that argument works with some people's fathers. It never worked well with mine. I don't know where that goes. I do think that, that Apple has, very interesting relationship with the record companies, and what goes on behind closed doors between Apple and those companies is really, anybody's guess. This may be one more thing that they'll be talking about, but mm-hmm. there is a lot of more important things at stake between the various record labels and Apple these days.
I think he hit it right on the head there. If any company is going to be able to push the record labels forward in this avenue, it's going to be Apple, because they're the ones, they brought it together with iTunes. They're the ones that have been really the driving force behind the record companies entering the digital age. So if anyone can do it, it's Apple and Steve Jobs. I think it's turtleneck power. That's what I think it
turtleneck
is.
Turtleneck power.
Yeah.
They're not really the company that is known in its dealings with the music industry and, increasingly the film industry too, of going forward and doing things by asking permission later. They generally seem to try and deal with these things up front. And I don't know enough about this to know whether that's happened here or whether they're trying to push things forward. But it will be interesting to watch. Kevin, you had a thought?
I was going to say that they are keeping rumored to be working on iTunes in the cloud, mm-hmm. where you'd be able to stream your iTunes or maybe, sort of work like a Pandora. Who knows? There's so much conjecture as to what's actually out there. I won't ascribe any features to it until I see Steve up on stage, saying what the features are.
Right. Well, there's this other company. I forget the name. The chat room will enlighten me. It's Og or Mog or something like that. not Og. That's obviously something else. But that I think is purporting to be able to give you access to your iTunes library, in addition to offering sort of Pandora-like services. So Apple certainly has a lot of competition out there on that front. And I think more and more people are wanting wherever they are to be able to access whatever they want and not get nicked for 99 cents every time they do so. So I think that they've got a challenge there, and maybe this is the way they're beginning to tackle it. So we'll have to stay tuned for that one. Also on the music front, recently what went into place are provisions of the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, where certain colleges and universities, in order to qualify for Title IX federal aid, had to implement various anti-piracy procedures. So the boom lowered on that just last month. And now they have to have various technology-based deterrents in place. They have to offer alternatives, which I think is a strange requirement to put on colleges and universities. How are you going to offer your students a legal alternative to illegal downloading when you yourself are not iTunes or any other service? And they have to do things like give a description of copyright laws and anti-piracy policies in place at the institution. Do you think that any of this is going to slow down determined P2P denizens, Alex?
It all depends on what the actual technical deterrents are. There was talk, and I haven't kept up on it, about doing some form of deep packet inspection at universities, which, frankly, the people that should be most worried about this this initiative are really the government agencies that are trying to snoop on some of this network traffic. Because if you move a whole generation of college students away from open clear text protocols and into encryption, you will essentially have created a group of people who, right from college, are all communicating through encrypted channels, which will make it much, much harder to find the encrypted channels that the law enforcement folks are looking for, and will make it much more likely that a casual user that that law enforcement is looking into will be using encryption. So I think that's the thing that I think is a bigger deal on this in the long term, especially if the technical deterrents are in fact useful. I mean, they'll over deter in a major way and over filter in a major way. But if that in fact does happen and start being adopted at college campuses, it'll have a serious law enforcement damage.
I want to mention that Greg Sandoval has more on this at his Media Maverick blog. And also that there's a great piece by John Hudson in The Atlantic called Four Reasons the Feds and Hollywood Shouldn't Fight Piracy Together. And just his four bullet points are: this crackdown is absurd, not a homeland security issue, this violates due process, and the government just looks silly. So apparently the people who authored this 08 Higher Education Opportunity Act hadn't read Mr. Hudson's piece or considered his points, but there we go. Jonathan, any thoughts?
My recollection of the law, and admittedly it's been a while since I actually looked at it, was that it was written very vaguely. The talk about technical procedures, to, you know, technical blocks and so forth, it was very vague, and there was a lot of head scratching on the part of universities as to what was actually required of them and what they were actually going to do. And I remember some time ago, I Googled once or twice trying to refine it. There was an article about how different universities were taking very vastly different approaches. Some were outright blocking P2P protocols, while others were just, you know, kind of more mildly shaping the network and taking very loose technical procedures. So I think it's going to be a few years before we really see the impact, as we kind of have to settle down what actually is required. I think right now people are still kind of clueless as to what the law actually wants people to do.
Right. Kevin, do you think that this is going to be a big deal, or that campuses have been already sort of towing the line on this issue for some time?
Well, they've certainly been on notice ever since Napster and some of those other services were popular. I seem to recall most of the campuses, the major ones, having procedures in place for dealing with that. I can't imagine this being any different. So certainly none of these schools want to lose their funding. So they're certainly going
right
to be
now.
Cooperating. Yes, exactly.
All right, well... Go ahead.
Sorry. Also, Jonathan raised a good point, which was around sort of the fact that different universities are doing this differently. And if I remember right, this law was proposed during a time when the recording industry was essentially threatening a bunch of different universities, trying to get them to do a bunch of different things. And so, to a certain extent, this is a way of taking those negotiations that were going on essentially privately between the parties and putting a floor in terms of what the universities had to do, which is basically trying to weaken their negotiating power within the that private negotiation, where the threat is always a lawsuit against the university if the university does not live up to the best practices of the recording industry. And one of the things that the universities could credibly do before this law is to say that they wouldn't even do some of these basic things, and certainly wouldn't do the technological deterrent measures without some agreement with the recording industry. And here you've got basically a raising of the floor there.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a break here to thank our sponsor, Hover.com. Coming up after the break, we're going to make the transition from music to porn and talk about the intersection of those two in a current legal issue. But before we get to that, I do want to let you know that this episode of TWiL is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the domain name registration and management site that's simple, and you can get 10% off any of the services they offer by going to twill.hover.com. Now, they offer all kinds of services They are a domain registration company. They are part of Tucows, which has been in that business for a very long time. But they're different than most domain registration companies you've dealt with in the past. Just go to hover.com and check out the site and you'll see what I mean. It is a very straightforward, simple interface. They're doing not a million different things at one time. They're doing certain discrete services, selling you domain names and email services. And I want to tell you about one particular thing that they offer that I find really, really useful and intriguing. And it's how the Hover name actually came to be, or what it means. When you hover something, you are creating a personalized URL, much like you could do with, say, a tiny URL or a bit.ly that shortens down, in most cases, a URL that you want to shorten, but it also makes it a much nicer package for you to use. So, for example, I use denise.howell.net, and when I go to something like, say, the video playlist for Twill on YouTube, and I want to send that link to somebody to say, hey, you know, here's where you can check out the videos of the show, which I did recently, I can use the bookmarklet in Firefox that Hover makes available and just tell Hover that I want to hover that link. And what that does is take it, and instead of being youtube.com/word salad of numbers and letters, it's denise.howell.net/videos, and you get right to that key link that I wind up sending around to people. So it's really, really convenient and nice, and the people there are wonderful. Their customer service has a policy of always answering the phone, not putting you on hold when you call during business hours, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. And their help section is really good. I was checking that out this morning. And for those of you who are fans of Net at Night, there are some great videos by Amber MacArthur walking you through a bunch of .tv registration considerations. So go ahead and head on over to hover.com at twill.hover.com. Get 10% off your services and let us know what you think. We love the service and we're really thrilled that they're a sponsor of This Week in Law. All right, so let's talk about music and porn, shall we? The music industry wants to begin collecting royalties on something used in music used in something called reality porn. Now, Eric Gardner over at the Hollywood Reporter Esquire had this story. Reality porn apparently is where actors lip sync to things like Justin Timberlake's Bringing Sexy Back, and they do some other things too, aside from just lip sync the music. And apparently the RIAA members such as Warner Brothers, et cetera, who have brought suit about this are none too pleased with it. Kevin, did you take a look at this? And are you surprised that the music industry is now turning its sights on the porn industry?
Certainly am not surprised at that. I wasn't particularly aware of this until I read the article. Also wasn't particularly surprised to see who the lawyer for the industry is.
Why was that surprising? It's Mitchell Silverberg and Nuff, right?
Surprising.
Oh, I see. Yes.
It's not. I loved Eric Gardner's comment
in his article where he mentions Mitchell Silverberg, the law firm. They're a West LA entertainment firm. He says, we imagine they had no trouble finding lawyers at the firm to research the case. Which brings me back to my summer associate days where we had some infringement case that involved video games. And we had to compare video games and see how similar or dissimilar they were. So I'm sure they had some very eager lawyers to work on this. Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say I happened to meet Mark Rondazza a few times at different events and stuff. He's a good guy and really interested in copyright. Of course, he's got probably some more interesting clients in this business. he's the lawyer for Reality Kings. In this particular case, I certainly can see if it was truly background music, that's one thing. But they're apparently lip syncing to the songs. Which is not a good thing from a defense standpoint. I think that's a good point in favor of the plaintiffs in that particular point. They're certainly making commercial use of that particular song, making a derivative work per se. And I certainly I'm interested to see how this comes out, but so far I think it's not going to be a fair use.
Yeah, I guess these could be really, really transformative works, though, depending on how creative the reality porn people decide to get. Alex, any thoughts on this?
I think it's a real shame. I mean, it's not not abnormal that porn gets to some of these copyright issues first, but it's a real shame that this is coming up there. If you take the pornographers at their word in terms of what the facts are, mm-hmm. this is like a background music. Mm-hmm. And the Documentary Filmmakers Associations have all been trying to come up with guidelines for what is and is not okay in the documentary context. And it would be really too bad if that was first addressed in a porn lip syncing context, as mm-hmm. opposed Great. To a poster on the back of some dorm room that's in a documentary context, or a song that happens to be playing in a bar when a documentary filmmaker is interviewing somebody.
Right. I mean, although we're not dealing in the same context of breaking CSS, it is a similar kind of issue about reuse mm-hmm. of copyrighted material in another work, as was just dealt with in the exemptions. So, it would be nice to have this issue decided legally, as opposed to how these things tend to get worked out behind the scenes in the context of, say, using music in YouTube videos. It would be nice to have a definitive answer from a court that might echo what the registrar has just done for documentary and non-commercial and educational filmmakers in the exemptions we were discussing. Jonathan, thoughts?
My only thought on this is, if I were the record industry, and I'm not, if I were going to bring this type of lawsuit, I would probably target the pornographers first. Reality Kings and so forth, I think, would be a pretty good target, because usually in these matters, especially with fair use, which is so fluid, and at times there's a lot of discretion in terms of how the law is applied and how it's interpreted. You go in against an unpopular opponent like this in the courts, it's an upper hand. It's unfortunate. And the reason I think, you're mentioning putting this in the documentary context is, if we looked at it in the context, if we removed the pornography element completely, suddenly you wouldn't have that, oh, it's the evil porn companies, let's go smite them. You would have a very different case there. And I don't know. I think the record industry picked their opponent very, very well in this one. I think it was a very deliberate act.
Right. Well, lest you think we are done with the porn stories for this episode of Twill, think again. Of course, Perfect 10 has been out there suing everyone, including Google, for years and years. This is the adult images site. And they recently had an adverse ruling, yet another adverse ruling, in one of their pieces of litigation that involved the DMCA and the insufficiency of the notices that that Perfect 10 was issuing as far as takedowns of things that... Sorry about that, folks. Little Skype weirdness there. So what I was saying is there's this new case that came out in Google's favor against Perfect 10 about the sufficiency of DMCA notices. So people will have to take heed of that when they are, again, it's unfortunate that we have all these things come up in the porn context, because they do have broader impact. And this applies to all sorts of DMCA notices. And then also there was an interesting portion of this decision that dealt with linking to infringing content, which was found to be okay on Google's part. So Alex, this is certainly something that might impact Twitter from a copyright standpoint. Did you have any thoughts on this one?
I'm going to do the lawyerly thing and pass on this one, because I was involved in the case, and I'm obviously very satisfied with it. I'll let other folks talk about it.
Okay. Kevin?
I will admit I haven't read the full opinion yet, but from what I've read of it, it certainly seems to be an interesting decision. I don't think it's that unheard of to require them to, require to specify the URL. After all, URL is Uniform Resource Locator. And so, if they're going to have to locate that resource, I think it's going to be... required to point out those, and I'm just not familiar enough with the other part of the decision to comment.
Right. Jonathan, any thoughts on the linking aspect of this or the DMCA aspect?
Well, I mean, as someone that files a decent amount of DMCA takedown notices, I can say that I've never been in perfect 10 shoes and had a DMCA notice rejected due to incompleteness by Google or by anyone else. Mr. McGillivray here received a lot of my notices during his tenure at Google, and they all went through just fine.
So yeah, Alex, I thought it was pretty cute that you tweeted recently that you were named one of the 50 most influential people in IP, though you were far more influential when you were back at Google. And, I don't know. I mean, you still have a very influential role. Maybe not so much in the policy arena as Google will take on those big battles, and maybe that's not your purview anymore. But I did very much enjoy reading recently about Twitter's shout out service and the official statement that came out on that. And I'm hoping that it was just wonderful. Folks, I'll put it in the show notes. Just a very conversational way of telling the world what this service was. And turns out it was something internal that was being used by Twitter employees, but it's not a product. And there were rumors that it was a product. And Twitter just, you know, had good humor and forthrightness in talking about it. And I'm hoping that we can thank Alex and his group for blessing that sort of public communication as well. So, you know, you are definitely influential in the way that Twitter is communicating if this is the kind of thing that meets with your approval. So don't sell yourself short, I guess is the point. All right. Well, let's talk to, if we've moved on from porn, there's no reason not to talk about Bratz Dolls, who are also in the news with their ongoing litigation from Barbie. A few years back, there was a very large lawsuit where Mattel went after MGA, the maker of Bratz Dolls, because a former Mattel employee had gone to that company, and Mattel alleged that the entire line of Bratz Dolls were the product of work that employee had done while at Mattel. And there was, at the trial court level, an injunction issued that prevented the sale of Bratz Dolls, preventing even use of the Bratz name, logo, trademark. And that injunction was just set aside, which is a pretty interesting point, actually, not just for the doll industry, but the technology industry, where people move around quite a bit, as we were just talking about, Alex, moving from Google to Twitter, Fred Von Lohman, another guest and welcome, always member of the Twill family, moved recently from EFF to Google. So I wonder, Alex, by the transitive property of Fred's, do you think that means you may see Fred over at Twitter one of these days?
I hope so. I'm a fan of I'm certainly a fan of his, but we could also just both meet back at the EFF or some other place.
Yes, exactly. So there's a lot of movement around in the technology industry as well. And this case goes to, you know, who owns what ideas and what sort of contract is going to be required in order for you to shut down an entire, you know, multi-million dollar division of a company based on the fact that somebody else's former employee works there and had an idea. Kevin, what do you think of all this?
Well, I thought it was a real interesting decision. The judge looked at it and basically said the contract says inventions were covered under the agreement, but this was not particularly an invention. Inventions typically cover things like patents or patentable ideas. They don't cover things that are trademarks or copyright protectable, and should have had other language in the agreement if they were going to actually cover that, or if that was intended to be covered. And there are lots of other, you know, parts of that particular contract that are interesting as well, as, you know, just, you know, what exactly, you know, they mean, you know, just what is spare time essentially for a person working at a company. You know, I mean, this guy was pretty assiduous and only worked on the Bratz, from what I understand of the facts. He only worked on the Bratz Dolls and truly in his spare time on the weekends. you know, for just to think of some of the hypotheticals and other cases, if, you know, lawyer or had a case where they were arguing and the particular person had done it over lunchtime, but, you know, still on the premises or, you know, using a work computer or something like that to actually do it. So I think it's a real interesting decision. I'm curious to see what's going to happen now that it's been sent back to the trial court.
Yeah, it will be interesting. There were a lot of things that the appellate court asked the trial court to look at and examine as having been done wrong the first time. So they're kind of starting over from square one. Jonathan, any thoughts?
Well, A, I found it kind of surprising that the appellate court really scolded the district court on this one, really took him to task on this. Basically, like you said, called out a lot of things they believe the court got wrong and basically threw the entire case back in the court's face. That's pretty unusual in my experience in these matters. But also, I think it highlights a lot of the complexities of this notion of work for hire in the modern age. Though it's not applicable to this case, we have the issue of freelancers and consultants and so forth being hired much, much more regularly. And where they fit in, it's not always very neat because, like I said, the law was not really written around that concept. But also, just people are moving around from job to job more than ever. These issues are going to keep coming up. And so it's an interesting case, and I'm definitely going to be following it closely for just that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Well, one thing I do want to pick all of your expert brains on that has been much in the news lately and much on my iPad, I've been enjoying it immensely, is Flipboard. And I do think that it presents some really interesting copyright twists. And I'm wondering, Alex, have you used it? And what do you think?
I haven't used Flipboard yet, so I don't really know exactly what the facts are from this particular mm-hmm. hypothetical. It sounded from some of the stories that they were reproducing sort of full articles. It sounded from other stories, the one you linked, that it wasn't that. It was something smaller. One of the interesting things was that it sounded like the CEO had received a whole bunch of comments from the folks that whose content he was using, and that he said that a lot of them were very positive. So it's hard to know exactly how this will play out. And of course, it'll all change over time. It does seem like a pretty cool product, though.
It's a really cool product. And I think that it's really interesting from the standpoint of it's really new, I think, that what it's doing. It's not a browser. It's not a search engine. It's not an aggregator. It is some mishmash of those things and its own thing as well. And I just don't know that the law as it has unfolded to date is really equipped to deal with it. I don't think that we've quite come to the point where, you know, people are just going to look at this and go, oh, it's an example of the scraper cases we had years ago. And of course they can't do this. But I think maybe there's a reason and a way that they can. I don't know exactly what that is at this point, but it just feels to me like something that can't be written off as clearly a copyright violation and a problem. Although they do seem to have taken the ask forgiveness, not permission model, at least on the front end. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, my understanding of a lot of the issues that people have had with it is that it takes RSS feeds and various other sources. It processes it. Correct me if I'm wrong. This, like I said, I do not even own an iPad. I feel very, very ashamed right now.
Don't be ashamed. You just have more restraint than the rest of us.
Either that or just less money, one or the other. They pass it through their servers. They do some kind of voodoo, and they present what they think would be most interesting and most relevant to you. And it's that idea that the data is stored, at least it's pulled from their servers, is where you get those scraper style issues and so forth, and where a lot of people have been raising red flags about it. I think you're absolutely right. The laws and the cases that have come up on these issues really don't address this. And, you know, we still have some questions, at least, about RSS scraping in general. So it's going to be very fascinating to see what happens with this one. And I think it was very bold of them to take the seek forgiveness route on this one. I think they're going to be seeking forgiveness pretty quickly, most likely.
Kevin, what do you think?
Well, Jonathan, don't feel bad. I don't own an iPad myself either.
Oh, thank you.
I personally am waiting for at least version 2. I'm also quite happy with my MacBook Pro. I don't didn't feel the need to buy another Apple product so soon after. You know, on this particular point, I agree that there are certain aspects of this that touch on things like the scraper cases, and I think you know, just for that part alone, I think that they seriously could be in trouble. So certainly it takes things that are in the RSS feed. My understanding is it also goes out and gets other things that are actually published to the site, but may or may not be intended to, be distributed in that fashion. I've heard of photo archives, that are sort of stripped out and then arranged in a different method than how the publisher intended, and that certainly gets into some of the rights of the copyright holder to decide how his work is publicly performed or publicly displayed. And I certainly think that's a real issue for a publisher. They certainly may want to work with Flipboard to come up with a Flipboard version. But I think they also could very easily be dealing with this situation where they may have to turn off access to certain sites at the request of the publisher, too.
We might be seeing a robots.txt type thing or something in this where publishers can opt out or opt in. I think that might be the way we end up going with this.
Mm-hmm. But my understanding is that they do honor the robots.txt, but I don't know for sure how.
I don't see how that would apply to this, really. I don't see how robots.txt would apply.
Right. Yeah. Did everybody, I know you did, Alex, because you tweeted it. Did everybody see the last FM robots.txt file, which included Asimov's three laws of robotics in machine-readable language? Just delightful. Evan sent that to me during the week, and it just made my day.
That was a good idea, just in case they missed it somewhere else. I mean,
yeah. Just wonderful.
That way, when Skynet cruises the internet, we'll be sure it has laws, and we'll be sure it knows and to obey them, and all will be good. Humanity has been saved by this, I'm sure.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to raise one more point with the Flipboard, which is just that, and I'll say I also don't have an iPad. But we've been talking about the sort of ask permission versus forgiveness, but all of that sort of presumes the answer to the question of whether they're infringing, whether there's any permission that actually needs to be asked for.
Right.
And I think that's a serious point, and it is something that I just don't know the answer to because I haven't seen enough of what the underlying facts would be. The other thing I would point to is that even absent the copyright law issue, the actual sites will have plenty of ability to get themselves out of this type of service. So even if it isn't a case where they needed to, in fact, ask permission under the law, it may have been a case where, because of the dynamics of the conversation that they're having with the publishing sites, where it might've been, wiser to ask permission.
I mean, they could just simply block the IP address of the server and be done with it. I mean, I'd imagine they can have some way to block it at least. If so motivated.
Can they? If they're scraping, I don't know. I suppose they can. I mean, that's. I remember way back in the technical solution,
but.
Yeah. Back in the trespass to chattels days of the eBay case, I think that they were able to take a measure that blocked the scraping that was happening there. So you may be right, but it's a lot of work to go through, I guess, if you're a publisher. At any rate, we have a couple of stories from Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt dealing with movie trailers that I thought were kind of interesting. Number one, Paramount is still going after people who are just happen to have their camera or phone or what have you and catch a glimpse of Transformers 3 being filmed and then post that up. They're getting takedown notices about those. And at Comic-Con, I guess the trailer of Thor coming out from Marvel was aired and people whipped out their cameras and phones, etc. At Comic-Con and then posted clips of the trailer or perhaps the whole trailer, and those have gotten DMCA'd too. And Mike Masnick had the great observation that, hey, it's a trailer. You want people to see it, but that doesn't mean that you want them to see it in a copyright violating sort of way, I guess. So Those have been going down. Any thoughts on Paramount or Marvel's actions here, Kevin?
Well, Chicago, I can tell you, has been going nuts over Transformers 3. you know, a couple times they had to remind people that, you know, the robots are CGI. You know, if you go to the site, you won't be able to see the robots. Yeah,
just these big mechs trekking through town.
No, we don't. But we do have plenty of fake gunfights and fake blowing up cars and all sorts of other fun things going on. If you happen to see some of the shooting sites and actually see some of the shooting videos, it's kind of interesting to see behind the scenes just how some of those special effects are performed. You know, it's a pretty boring effect until they add the explosion later.
Both the complaints are about things that are so actually beneficial to the goals of the company. You know, they want to get word out and hype out and buzz out. And that's what's happening. But, you know, God forbid the videos actually stay somewhere visible. Alex, any thoughts?
Well, so much of this is about control, right? And they want to control exactly how these things get out. And you know, to the extent that they are rights protected by the Copyright Act, this certainly gives them that control.
Right.
Issue with the Transformers recording is that it's debatable what they have underneath the Copyright Act to protect those recordings, because they are being recorded by someone standing there at the scene. They're not property of, I believe it's Paramount doing the film. So it's not their footage.
Right. They're out in the open in public. Anyone could walk by and take a film.
And these are people flipping out their iPhone 4s recording video. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's exactly all it is. And I think that's why these are sort of bogus takedowns.
Yeah, I agree they are. I would agree strongly that they are.
Yeah, and then the other shoe that drops on that is that, you know, people who are just happening by and filming these and putting them up, if they get taken down, they're not really in a position of knowing, okay, well, that's got to be bogus and I can contest that, you know, unless you're... Yeah. Wendy Seltzer or somebody.
I was about to say, we need to send Wendy Seltzer to Chicago to record some of this.
Exactly. So that's kind of the tragedy of the DMCA playing itself out in this situation. But it doesn't really also seem to be slowing people down. The trailers keep going up. So I guess everybody wins. Paramount exercises its control and gets its hype at the same time. So I have a bunch of stories here that I just wanted to kind of go through quickly and get your impressions on. Big rumors yesterday about Google and Verizon being in talks about making some kind of deal on net neutrality. Google immediately squelched that. In fact, they squelched it on Twitter first. They tweeted out at NY Times is just wrong. Is this just... I guess it's interesting from the standpoint of how fast this moved. It's interesting from the standpoint of apparently the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, who both had big stories on this, were either way off or Google is. What do you think, Alex?
I think part of it is the complexity of the issue. And then the other thing I would say it really signals is just how engaged actual people are. I mean, the fact that you had a correction so quickly, the fact that there were literally, I counted a half a dozen stories within a few minutes that were talking about how this was going to end the internet. People are really paying attention to this issue, and it's not just the lawyers, it's not just the big companies.
Right.
Yeah, this is probably the most passion I've seen on any issue in a long time on the internet. This is it's a great way to start a fight if ever you're in the mood, like a bar with a bunch of nerds. I mean, it's a great tool for getting your butt kicked. But other than that, it's the passion. It's all about how people feel about this.
Right. It's not like the New York Times to go with a story that doesn't have some basis in fact, but clearly it's been as unequivocally denied as it could be. So, you know, I don't really know where that stands. Kevin, any thoughts?
Oh, not much more in addition to what's been said. Network neutrality, I think, is still certainly an issue for a lot of people. It's certainly one that I personally have been following for quite a long time. And to think that two of the big players could be trying to come up with a side deal that would blow the whole thing out of the water would certainly be distressing to a lot of people on both sides of the issue. And I certainly am interested in seeing what finally comes out. But must have hit close to the mark. They certainly had some talks, but just exactly what those talks were about, I think that's where Google's out saying no, that's not exactly what we were saying, and it's been misreported, and I forget how else they described it other than just being flat out wrong.
Well, here's another takedown instance. The FBI doesn't like that Wikipedia had a copy of its seal on the encyclopedia entry about the FBI. I guess the concern there is that somebody could take that high-resolution digital copy and try and dummy up some FBI credentials. But Wikipedia is fighting back and saying, no, we get to use the seal for this kind of a purpose. So, and Cindy Cohn from the EFF says... the whole thing is silly and troubling. Any thoughts here, Alex, on putting such a thing on an encyclopedia entry?
So it's like a birthday present, Christmas present, and just this huge gift for Wikipedia that the FBI wants to make a big deal out of this. I can almost see Mike Godwin in his office just overjoyed with the fact that the FBI is pushing this. It couldn't be a better fundraising tactic for the Wikipedia Foundation. Mm-hmm. And you can just read from the letter just how much fun Mike is having with this. I mean, mm-hmm. pointing to the Encyclopedia Britannica, which of course is the same thing, using all sorts of wonderful Latin. And and my favorite bit is the sign off, which is not with all due respect, but with all appropriate respect.
Yeah. So it's just as in none is due.
Yeah, it was just I don't know. Mike has been the general counsel of the Wikimedia Foundation now, I think, for a number of years, 3 or 4 years, and this is probably one of the funnest things he's gotten to deal with yet.
Funnest.
That's a word. Right?
Yes, funnest.
Absolutely. Jonathan, are you worried that people would be copying some image and able to actually fool someone into thinking that they're an FBI official?
Well, as a guy that actually had a job once making authorized fake IDs for the military, it was a weird story. I was right after Hurricane Katrina and the military's badge printer was down. So I had that duty for a few months. But it was strange. But no, I don't really think this is going to happen. It's not, I just don't see it, quite frankly. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And even if it did, I think Wikimedia would have a ton of protection on its part. I don't think it has anything to worry about. I think Mike's response was highly appropriate in this case.
Wonderful. Well, for all you folks out there who are not fortunate enough to have someone like Alex as your general counsel at your stealth mode, very early stage startup, you can head on over to Read Write Web, where there is a great article called Avoiding Common Legal Oversights on Your Startup's Website by Audrey Waters, I believe is her name. And that is our tip of the week. They tell you some common mistakes that people often make when their businesses are just getting going. They have no formal policies. They have bad contracts, no coordination. They're flat out breaking the law. They're failing to protect their own intellectual property. They have security breaches. They're infringing on other people's intellectual property. They have privacy breaches, and they have no disclaimers, whether humorous and lighthearted or not, on their website. So great little tips over there. Thank you to Audrey at Read White Write Web for providing our tip of the week. Our resource of the week is going to be thanks to our guest, Alex, who maintains an incredible list of great minds, or minds at any rate. I'm on there, so I can't really attest to the first adjective, but folks who think about internet law on a regular basis, in his Twitter list of a wonderful aggregation of those kinds of folks. So if you go to Alex's Twitter account, which is McGill, M-A-C-G-I-L-L, on Twitter, you'll see his list there of internet law folks, which is growing every day and a wonderful resource. So thank you so much, Alex, for that. And that'll be our resource of the week. And I have to say, too, I'm really loving what just kind of quietly appeared on my Twitter page in the last couple of days, the new who to follow recommendations. Those rock. I have to say,
that's great. I'm really pleased.
Yeah,
we've been working on those for a while, and they've been helpful to me too in terms of me being able to see them. They're great for adding folks to that internet law list too.
Yeah, whatever is going on behind the scenes there to come up with the recommendations is really effective, because you know I look at that, just I haven't really gone too often to the whole suggested list, but just that catches my eye once or twice a day. And I wind up thinking, you know, oh, well, that's somebody I thought I was already following. So that's a wonderful resource there, too. And thank you to Twitter for giving that to us.
Yeah, that is an awesome tool.
Yeah. So
keep using Twitter. So keep me in a job.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, we'd love to do that. We'd love to have you back on the show sometime, Alex. But we really appreciate your joining us this week. Folks, as I said, can find Alex on Twitter at McGill, M-A-C-G-I-L-L, and he blogs at brickalure.org. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure. I really appreciate what you all do every week.
Thank you. And Kevin, thanks again for coming on the show over there at cyberlawcentral.com.
Thank you again for having me. I'm also at Cyberlaw on Twitter, and I believe I'm also on Alex's list. But thank you again, and it's been wonderful to be on.
Fantastic having you back. And Jonathan, stay cool down there in Hurricane Land. We are thrilled to have been part of your New Orleans Friday. And folks can check Jonathan out at Plagiarism Today on Twitter and plagiarismtoday.com.
Thank you very much.
Great having you. And thanks to everyone in the chat room. Thanks to everyone who contributes to our Facebook page, which folks can check out at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. We post up pre-show questions and love to get your feedback and input on the show. And with that, we'll wrap up TWIL episode 72, and we'll see you next week, Friday, 11 a.m., recording live at live.twit.tv. Take care, everyone.